Well, as Edwin asked me to think about talking to you about these people, it occurred to me that you might wonder why, given all the things we could ask you to read, we choose things that have words like alacrity or have really long, complex sentences that are punctuated quite differently than you use your punctuation today. Or just keep referring to the King James Version of the Bible and don't seem to know that the New International Version is out there, or whatever. Certainly there are plenty of more contemporary devotional books out there. Lots of people want us to buy what they have. They market all kinds of devotional thoughts, and you probably have some of them and love some of them. So why do we pick these things? Why do we turn to these people? And so I'm inviting you to think a little bit about that with me tonight. Part of the reason, I'll give you a hint at the beginning, is that these are the people who most influenced the people who founded this camp and who established the churches and the parts of the fellowship that we hold so dear and that really shape who we are. And so it's important for us to remember that we're connected. You know, we're not just contemporary people who enjoy the moment, but there are roots that tie us way back, and they keep going back and back, and God has done wonderful things over the years, and parts of God's work have become particularly precious to us. Doesn't mean that what God has done for others is less important to us, but he's given us some truths and some emphases. And so we try to give you a chance to think about those things and remember the founding principles, and also to challenge your vocabulary a little bit. You know, keep that reading level up during the summer vacation. Make you read closely and carefully, and maybe make you curious about expanding your vocabulary. That would be good if you looked up those words. But my brother said the other day that I'm a historian. And I'd just like to talk to you a little bit then about these people from the perspective of sources and the reliability of sources. Sources are something that I think about all the time. So, Cozy, you're going to write a paper. I hope you're going to write a paper for a history class, all right? What kinds of sources would you, how would you evaluate sources? How would you find something to study the Civil War? Where would you start? Probably online.
Yeah.
Okay, what would you do online?
Google it.
You'd Google it, great. All right, so you come up with lots of domains. You come up with some .edu and .com and .gov and .org. All right, you got all these domains out there. How do you narrow down the 653,789 hits, you know, that your search gives you? How do you narrow that down and discover which of those hits might be a reliable source? Yeah, okay, all right. That's probably more true for more students than we'd like to admit. Well, this is why I teach the introduction to this, but any other ideas? I don't want to put Cozy on the spot. I don't think he writes a whole lot of history papers, so he's really stretching to help me here. I know I have some science people back there. It seems like everybody from Maryland is into science or engineering, so I don't want to put them on the spot either. But just think about this a little bit. If you look at the sites that say .com, then anybody can have posted them, right? And they may have been posted a long time ago and not tended, not updated, not renewed. Or they may just represent the ideas, the interests of the particular person whose site that is. If you go, now, no, nothing's perfect, okay? I'm not trying to say that everything that says .gov doesn't have an agenda. But if it's a .gov site, you know that the government is updating and presenting and, we would hope, keeping accurate the documents that it posts. If you go to a .edu site, it's extremely difficult to be a .edu. A college can have a .edu site, a university can have it, but an entity within that college can't have its own. A .edu site means something. So if a site, if you're, you know, if 20,000 of your hits have .edus after them, you can know that there's a greater chance that somebody who knows something about this, the librarians or the archivists, you know, people are maintaining these sites, people are caring for the sources. So your sources really matter. Just one quick illustration. Right before I came to camp, I haven't even quite finished this. I'm up to the last chapter of a really good book that I was asked to read for a press that before books are published, they get distributed for reading and criticism and the question, should they be published? And so I'm reading this book, and it's about Thanksgiving. All right, everybody here celebrates Thanksgiving. So what do you think the essential components of Thanksgiving are? When you celebrate Thanksgiving, what do you need to have for it to feel like Thanksgiving? How about you, Eric?
A lot of food.
You need a lot of food. That's kind of what I thought we'd start with. Anybody else? What else do you need?
A thankful heart.
A thankful heart, all right. Well, you know, we have about 150 words. I know there are fewer than 200 words in the original sources that describe what we think of as the first Thanksgiving. And the little bit of description that we have of that supposed first Thanksgiving, which happened in what year? Anybody know? 16, yeah, we got the 16 right. I heard that from over there. Now you guys fill in the rest. 16 from this side. When did the pilgrims land? Okay, we're going to have to do something about this.
Breakfast is at 7:30 tomorrow morning. Before you get served,
you will tell me this. Okay, so they landed in at the very end of 1620, so that first Thanksgiving would probably have happened about 1621, maybe? Okay, you're all agreeing with that far. Anyway, we won't belabor that point. I guess we won't push it too far. But much of what we think of as Thanksgiving is completely absent from the sources. Completely absent. If you go back to the original, most reliable sources, one of them was written as a promotional piece for the Plymouth Colony so that the investors would think it was doing okay and they would invest more money in it. So its purpose was to make Plymouth look pretty good. You know, and things were going right, and they were getting along with the Indians, and things were, you know, so this was good. And the other one was a little bit more objective, but there's very, very little. And the pictures that you may have in your head about pilgrims and Indians sitting down together at long tables, and, you know, all of that comes from the 1890s, right? So we're talking about like 270 years later. And the source, the main source that this historian has identified, I think quite convincingly, is historical fiction that was published in the 1890s, became a bestseller, went through something like 30 editions by a woman named Jane Austen. But it wasn't the Pride and Prejudice Jane Austen. Okay, she spelled it differently. It was Austen with an I-N. This is picked up then by popular magazines. It's illustrated. She's got a great story, so you can illustrate it now. You know what it looked like because she described it to you. And you get this whole kind of myth of something that happened. And when you take it back to the original sources, there's very little of it there. And the question becomes, where did this come from? I don't want to go there. I'm not talking about Thanksgiving tonight. And the story of Thanksgiving serves a very important purpose in our country's history and all of that. So that's another issue. But the point being that the sources are quite varied. And if our traditions come and our artwork comes out of historical fiction, which is 99.9% fiction and about maybe 0.01% history, you know, we need to be concerned about some of the things that we pass off as truth. And the same is true and much more seriously, perhaps, for us, spiritually true about all the things that we can read these days, all the things we can buy, all the things that are marketed to us as helps for understanding our Christian lives and the service of God. And so when we look to these readings that we have here, I guess my main point is that these are people who are good sources. They have the right, the authority to say what they say to us day by day because they lived lives that bore out what they said. You know, you can find books by people who may be living immoral lives on the side, you know, nobody knows, and then they fall, or all kinds of people in religious business for money or for marketing or whatever reason. But these are people who it's worth listening to because they lived the life and because we, as third, fourth, fifth generation now, beneficiaries through our fellowship and through camp and other connections, still benefit from the teaching that they implanted in the hearts of the people to whom we owe our understanding of the Christian life. So let me begin just really quickly. All I intend to do is to name them and to tell you just a very little bit about them, kind of why you should listen to them, or something specific that God did for them or through them, and then maybe give you a thought that comes from their own words. I'm going to begin with Spurgeon, because we grew up in a home where we read Spurgeon every single day. And we weren't the first generation in our family that read Spurgeon every day. And we still read Spurgeon every day at both of our homes. And our children read Spurgeon every day. So Spurgeon is a formative influence on our lives. Charles Spurgeon, great preacher. If you had lived in England any time from about 1860 to 1890, you would have known the name of Charles Spurgeon. No television preacher today was bigger than Charles Spurgeon was in England and throughout the English-speaking world. Now, Charles Spurgeon founded Sunday schools. He founded an orphanage. He founded a preacher's college. He was the pastor of an enormous church, preached to thousands and thousands of people every week. He edited a monthly magazine. And through all of that busyness, he lived out what he preached and taught. And he had an amazing capacity for remembering things. One of his admirers said, described him this way. This is about Spurgeon. He whose life is lightning, his words are thunder for God. All right, so if your life is lightning, could be true about you too. Your words can be thunder for God. Another person said he lives in the spiritual tropics. Now, it's either hot or cold in his mind. None of that limping between two opinions we heard about last night. You know where you belong, and you're there. When he was converted, he wrote down a covenant. And it read in part like this: as thy reasonable sacrifice, this is God, God is the thy, as thy reasonable sacrifice, I return to thee thine own. I would be forever unreservedly, perpetually thine. While I am on earth, I would serve thee. All right, so he did still use that old form for addressing God. The these and the thines were part of his vocabulary. He was a Baptist man whose family wasn't Baptist, but his family were Christians. His grandfather was a preacher, and he was well-read in Pilgrim's Progress and other such Christian classics, even as a young man. But when he decided God wanted him to be baptized, now I invite you to think about how many of you were baptized on this side? You've been baptized? All right, listen to the day when he got baptized, all right? This was such a serious covenant that he felt he was making with God. And he's doing it alone because his family believed in infant baptism. And they approved his doing this, but they didn't encourage it or teach him to go that way. He got up in the morning and he spent 2 hours in prayer. And then he walked 8 miles to the river where the Baptists were meeting to have a baptismal service. Now just think about how seriously he took this. This was a whole day long project. 2 hours in prayer, 8 hours walking. Of course he had 8 miles walking. Of course he had to walk back, you know, after it was all over. But this was his time to make his public commitment. And when they arrived, there's no church with a baptistry. They did this all outdoors, and there was a ferry crossing, and he wrote about how there were people on boats and pleasure excursions going on, and people were watching. And this is in England, where 99% of the people would have been baptized as infants. And so they made fun of these Baptists. And he said, you know, then and there, God took away my timidity. It's like, okay, I'm going to do this. And when I walked into those waters and I was baptized, God did something for me, and he set me free to speak and to be bolder in his service. He gave out tracts right away, spent Saturday afternoons visiting homes and giving out Christian literature. And then, you know, he lived in a day when people knew the Bible stories, because you read the Bible in school. So it was a lot different from today. And there's one story which is great. He saw somebody he knew walking toward a county fair, and in the county fair there was a tent where there was dancing. So he walked up to the entrance of that tent with this person and supposedly said to them, "What doest thou there, Elijah? Art thou going in there?" You know, he could lift it right out of the King James Version and just throw it out. I think the person kept walking in. I don't think it stopped him, but I mean, it was just an interesting way. The Bible was the way he spoke. The biblical language just infused what he said. So here are two entries from his diary that I thought were interesting. When he read the Bible, every single thing he read, it seems like, became a prayer or a concern for him. He didn't just kind of read the story, you know. He stopped and read. So when he was reading in Acts 17 one day, he read a section that talked about how Paul went to Berea, and the Berean Jews were more noble than those in Thessalonica because they were examining the scriptures to see if what Paul was saying was true. And in Spurgeon's diary it says, "Lord, give me much of Berean nobility." What does that mean? Make me search the scriptures that way too. I read it, I want that too. Every time Spurgeon signed a book or wrote his name in a guest book or whatever, these were the words that he wanted to be known by. And then I'm going to leave him be. But listen to this. These are words that many of you will know. "Ere since by faith I saw the stream thy flowing wounds supply, redeeming love has been my theme and shall be till I die." Something that we sing still, precious to him, and came to be his self-presentation. That's how he wanted to be remembered in books. So, Charles Spurgeon, a great giant of the pulpit, a writer, a passionate, zealous. We heard something about the word zeal too, didn't we? And all of these people are characterized by zeal. Next, F.B. Meyer. F.B. Meyer was another Baptist. His name was really Frederick Brotherton Meyer. But in his day, people who had names like that tended to use their initials instead. So he went by F.B. Meyer. And he was a pastor who grew up, again, in a Christian home. And his church was called his abiding monument. He didn't have a big stone to him, you know, a big pillar put up in his memory, lots of paintings placed in museums. But he created a church and pastored a church for a very long time in England that came to be known as the Church of the Cordial Welcome. Now that might have a little old-fashioned sound to it, but that's not a bad thing for a church to be known as, is it? The Church of the Cordial Welcome. When I was studying Fanny Crosby, who wrote Blessed Assurance, which we just sang, I came across frequent mention of a church in New York City, which was in the New York Times rather often, called the Church of the Stranger. Now, and I always thought, that is such an odd name for a church. I mean, why would I go to a church that's called the Church of the Stranger? And I think back in that day, it was intended to be a welcoming place for if you don't fit anywhere else and you don't feel comfortable just going to some other church that has its program going, come here, come to the Church of the Stranger. Everybody here is just going to welcome you. That's an odd way of putting it in our day, but that's how it used to be. And I think this is a much better name, the Church of the Cordial Welcome. And he became a great Bible teacher, a traveler. He came to the United States frequently, actually. When he was 80, he made his last trip in the 1920s. And he preached to huge, huge conferences, young people's conferences, summer meetings of youth leaders, YMCA leaders, student volunteer, missionary leaders, as a sort of father figure that they all loved and admired. Make the most of me. This was his life's motto. Now just listen to this and then we'll move on. Make the most of me that can be made for thy glory. All right, so as Spurgeon had that hymn, redeeming love has been my theme. F.B. Meyer has this, make the most of me that can be made for thy glory. Then we move on to G. Campbell Morgan, George Campbell Morgan, who was also British. There were some interesting things going on in Britain that brought all of these people who knew each other and shared conference platforms into prominence at about the same time. Campbell Morgan began preaching publicly when he was 13. And let me tell you, if you want a sermon to preach sometime, if you're put on the spot, his outline from when he was 13 is not bad. He always preached 4 points. A lot of preachers do 3. He did 4. That was his signature thing. 4 points to every sermon. You could probably get a lot of this sermon with just his headings. Okay, so we start with a great salvation, a common salvation, eternal salvation, and a present salvation. This is a 13-year-old. Now, he had practiced since he was much younger. He started practicing when he was 7 by having his sister line up her dolls, putting a tablecloth over a table, coming into his sister's room with his notes and his Bible, and preaching. And he said, I have always known it was my duty to preach. And here's a quote, I do not think I have ever preached with greater devotion than I did when I was 8 years old. Okay, to all those dolls and his sister. But at any rate, he began very young and always felt called to be a minister. And here's a newspaper ad. Wouldn't you like, if you were an evangelist or you're a preacher, this is the kind of ad you'd like to have. From a small town in England when he was a young man still, a very young preacher, a teenager still. His Satanic Majesty is having a rather difficult time of it here just now. The Wesleyans are taking up the cudgels against the Prince of Evil with Mr. Campbell Morgan to champion their cause. All right, 16-year-old, not bad. So here's a man who felt God's call in his life and really disciplined himself, education-wise, just went right on doing what he could to prepare himself. And here's what he said, something that I think some of us could relate to. My father did not compel me to become a Christian. I had no choice because of what I saw in him. You know? If you have no opposition, in the place you serve, you're serving in the wrong place. Think about that with Christian service, huh? And here, we talk a lot about waiting on God. He had something to say about that, too. These are just a few lines. There are so many quotable things. Waiting on God means, first, activity under God's commands. Second, readiness for any new command. Third, the ability to do nothing until God gives a command. It is not laziness, it's not going to sleep, and it's not giving up trying. All right, so these are just a couple of quotes from him. Now, the things that we have in our readings from G. Campbell Morgan actually were preached to a youth conference up in Northfield, Massachusetts in 1902. I believe he was here. And he preached it. Dwight Moody, the great evangelist of the 19th century, had begun a conference for young Christian college guys, basically. Hundreds of them came up every summer. And G. Campbell Morgan went there and preached. And they took apart his sermons and put them into little snippets for devotional reading so that you could take Northfield home with you for the rest of the year. So that's where these things come from. They were preached to young people like you. And their thoughts on serving God and being, we call you to no ignoble service when we call you to the king, but to serve the king. You must kiss the scepter and own allegiance to him. This is how our readings end. Those were words preached to that youth conference. Very quickly, Andrew Murray, I guess he had a middle name. I must confess I don't know what it was offhand. He's one of the few people from this time period who doesn't have two initials and a last name. He went by Andrew. Andrew Murray's father was a missionary from Scotland to South. I mean, yeah, from Scotland, the Reformed Church of Scotland, to South Africa. And so he grew up with his siblings in South Africa as a missionary kid. And he grew up in a home where they were always praying for a revival in South Africa. I mean, his father was a missionary. His father wanted to help convert the people who lived there. And so they were always praying for revival, and they were always hosting other missionaries. And it was a very active home full of Christian service. So we grew up reading about revivals, praying for revivals, and again, really seemed to sense no choice but to become a preacher. This is what he knew God wanted him to do from childhood on. And so he and his brother went to Scotland and England and then to the Netherlands for education and training. They did the best they could do and went straight through, kept that goal in mind. Then he went back to South Africa as a preacher. And he was doing really well. Actually, he was into education for girls. He's a pioneer in female education in South Africa. And he was traveling out on horseback for weeks at a time to preach to farmers who were way out, away from the villages and away from the churches in South Africa, Dutch farmers. And the principle that he saw, that he tried to put into the education that he supported was education supposed to be for the head and also for the heart and for the hands. Do something. Service. It's not all just learning. It has to reach your heart and make you act. And those things all go together. So he was a very prominent young minister who was becoming noticed when all of a sudden something really odd happened to him. He had some problem with his throat that developed into a very serious difficulty that kept him from speaking. And if you read about his life, there were two silent years. But of course, when he was living those two silent years, he didn't know they would just be two, right? He had no voice, and his whole career, everything he felt God called him to do, depended on his voice. And during that time, he began to read books by other people who also were influential on some of the founders of this fellowship. who were trying to understand what the New Testament taught about healing and the work of God in quickening our bodies. And after he corresponded with and read some of the writings by people in Switzerland and in Germany, he traveled to England. And in England, there was a faith home that was run by an American who had gone that way in the 1870s, a Presbyterian man from Ohio. And in his faith home, this Andrew Murray stayed for a while because he wanted to learn about healing. And there he was prayed for, and he was healed. And during that, and his voice came back, and he lived on for another 30 years of preaching and ministering publicly. But during that difficult time, he also, he said, came under a very close self-examination and dealing with his relationship with God and all that he learned about all that God wanted to do for his people now, not just in Bible times, but now, healing those who are sick and giving the power of the Holy Spirit to any who would ask to make them live victorious Christian lives. All of those things came more fully into his understanding. And so of these various people we talk about, he wrote a lot about the inward life, about humility, and about our close relationship to Jesus. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, he had today's reading was his. And he talks here, remember, about God giving grace for service. God just doesn't give us his grace to make us feel good or feel rich or feel blessed, but gives us his grace so that we can be his vessels in this world. At another point, he said, our love to God is measured by our everyday fellowship with others and the love that it displays. All right, now we've talked before about Frances Ridley Havergal. I'm not going to say much about her at all tonight, but she's written a couple of our readings too. You know some other hymns that she's written beside the one that we have here, Who is on the Lord's Side. Some of you will know, Like a River, Glorious is God's Perfect Peace, which she was part of the group out of which that came in the editing of that hymnal. But she wrote other hymns like Take My Life and Let It Be was hers, of course, and that's a better known one. But she was a collaborator of James Mountain's on that other one, too, in the music as well as in the text. So she's, we embrace her, what are some of the others that are in the camp? I know there are more in the camp book. My mind is just a little, live out thy life within me, a life of overcoming was the one I was trying to think of, right? A life of ceaseless praise. Is that hers too? Or live out thy life within me. Anyway, there are others. And so she's represented to us most frequently through the hymns that we sing. A lot of these other people didn't write hymns, or they wrote hymns that were not as popular as the ones that she wrote. So there are all the devotionals that she wrote from which these readings come, but also these other things. So these are just a few of the people that we are relying on for direction in what it means to serve the Lord. And I'm just going to conclude by saying that the topic that my brother felt that he should use this year, the service of the Lord, led me to a little book on my shelf that's been there for a very long time, and I've looked at it periodically. It's a little paperback book called The Meaning of Service, and I've read in it, but I decided to read it a little bit more systematically. And one of the things that's not in here, and I just leave it to you as a challenge, that is maybe the second or the third chapter in this book, second chapter, it's called The Peril of Uselessness. We've got a lot in here about service and serving others and serving the Lord, but I was struck by this notion of the peril of uselessness. And he talks about how if you look at the New Testament, Jesus' harshest words were not necessarily for the people who outright opposed him, right? It's for the people who did nothing. The one who buried his talent. Or those who are coming before him saying, you know, can't we come in? And no, you didn't do this. You didn't, I was in prison, you didn't visit me. I was thirsty, you didn't give me a drink. I was, you know. So the peril of uselessness, I would just leave as a thought with us too, as something that really I think completes this. It's not an option. This question of service is really part of what it means to be a Christian. You really could go to the point of saying you're not Christian unless you're a servant. And what these readings do is give us dimensions to that, talk to us about what service means, serving one another, serving the Lord. But it's all about what it means to be a Christian, not as if this is something added on. And just in conclusion, let me just read a couple of words, all right? The issue is not a life which seeks first to be right and then to go out and serve. That's another thing. I've got to get everything straight and then I can serve the Lord, all right? No, that's not the point. Victorious living and practical service cannot be chronologically arranged. Hope that's encouraging to somebody. They grow together. So even if you're not perfect, you can do this. They're mutually influential. They're indispensable to each other's health and wholeness. As one reads the New Testament, he becomes aware that the epistle to the Hebrews gives a true description of the fully Christian life of the first Christians. And the climax of the description is the gist of the whole matter. Those first Christians had tasted the powers of the age to come. I think that we could say that of each of these people that I talked briefly about today. God had led them to a place where they glimpsed something that beckoned them from complacency and made them want to be zealous in God's service. They believed a new day of righteousness was going to appear on earth when God's long plans would come to glorious fulfillment, that coming age they loved. To its ideals they were devoted. For it they would die. They were patriots for a day not yet arrived. I think that's a challenge for all of us, to be patriots for a day that is coming, that God promises will come. And in that sense, we're all revolutionaries, all right? We're countercultural because we're serving the Lord. And I'm going to stop there. And before I start preaching.